Welcome to Nell and Matt's Obsolete Movies, the podcast where we review movies from our 20 plus years together of collecting films on obsolete formats, basically films of the VHS era. And for today's episode, first of all, it probably sounds very different. We haven't had a turn signal indicator sound before. So we are in a car driving somewhere, but still want to record an episode. So sorry, room tone going to be radically different this week. Our film for this episode is Dead Poets Society from 1989. And we have it on VHS, and I don't know, I think I stole it from my mom. I think it was in Columbia House, had like a, you know, record club, but for movies, you know, 10 VHS tapes for a quarter. What could go wrong? And, what could go wrong is 30 some odd years later, you have a copy of Dead Poets Society on VHS.
Yeah,
and you watch it.
We literally had to have a serious conversation about this because I was like, did you buy it? And you're like, did you buy it? We had to figure out who actually was the one who brought it into the house. And we think it's because Matt took it from his mom.
Yeah. Or we stole it from our friend Dave. I forget. That's the other possibility. Or, you know, Dave lived with us for a while and then he left and then maybe he just didn't take everything with him. I don't know.
If that's the case, sorry, Dave. It was unintentional.
Yeah, sorry, Dave.
Thanks, Mingle. Co-mingles.
Yeah.
It is what it is.
It is what it is. And I guess we should say that, like, our full disclosure, our disavowal of having purchased this particular tape is because we bring to it a certain baggage or a certain perspective in that we are both in education.
Yes.
And we got to talk about maybe now, maybe later, how this film perhaps ruined an entire generation of teachers and the entire subject of literature studies at all forever.
Absolutely. That kind of myth of this super teacher who can come in and transform a class all through the strength of conviction and personality has really impacted how people view education.
And future educators.
Absolutely.
I mean, I have this dream of, you know, interviewing a potential future colleague and shutting the interview down. They say, well, I saw Dead Poets Society and I decided I wanted to become an English professor. I'm out. That's it. You're done. You don't know what you're doing. But I guess for the few folks who haven't seen the film, maybe should we just plot real quick, stuffy, New England-ish-esque? I don't even
Vermont.
Know.
It's supposed to be Vermont.
Vermont, there we go. All boys, private, prestigious prep school, built on the English model, boarding school, and it's 1955, and they're repressed, and, oh no, 1959, sorry, 1959, everybody's super repressed, and repressed. And then comes, you know, Robin Williams doing stand-up in the classroom, telling people to, you know, stand on their desks, rip the introduction right out of the book. You don't need it.
Yeah.
And then chaos ensues.
Yeah. And his character's name is John Keating. And he's really into poetry and this belief in the power of poetry. His new students, because his first day of class, he comes in whistling and just walks around the room whistling, then walks out and gets them to follow, and they all become fascinated with him because obviously he's this like different kind of guy. So they find his yearbook and look up that he was a part of a member of an organization called the Dead Poets Society. So they ask him about it, and he explains it was a group of students who got together reading poetry. And so these group of boys are now fascinated by John Keating, decide to start their own Dead Poets Society and start meeting in the evenings to read poetry to each other.
In a cave.
In a cave.
Somewhere on campus grounds.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And because they start doing that, supposedly some of them become more freer thinkers.
Yes.
And again, as Matt said, trouble ensues with that.
Yes. Which, I mean, so part of the trouble is, of course, there's a student suicide, which is always kind of a terrible thing to think about, terrible thing to portray. It happens in the last 20 minutes of the film. And so one of the many, many, many flaws in this film, we'll go in further on in terms of education and the representation of education, is that you have a lot of characters, a lot of story, but I don't know if you have a plot. I don't know if you have a through line.
Yeah.
Until the real conflict in, like, the last 20 minutes of the movie.
It's almost like these vignettes. Like, these yes. little vignettes that happen that really don't create a comprehensive film. And also the boy characters get muddled.
Yes.
And so, like, who is who and what's that one's motivation?
What's their conflict and what's their, challenge? And
you know, Ethan Hawke is probably the most well-known of the boys. Of the boy group, but like it is just like five or six boys who become the core who are really into John Keating and follow him. But because they're kind of all like upper middle class, wealthy white boys, you kind of with brown hair, like they all literally
that are parted to the left.
One has one red hair. But they're all just kind of look the same, act the same, have the same system of beliefs, and so it's really hard to really connect with them and kind of distinguish them and their stories, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So that's a flaw. the other bone to pick we have is, you know, it's a movie that's supposed to be about the transformative power of poetry, but they actually read very little poetry. They also only rebel within the canon. So basically, it's young, wealthy white men reading what one of my English professors in grad school explained, called the Dwems, the dead, wealthy English.
This is true.
Dead, wealthy English men.
Yes.
The Dwems.
Dwems. I like
the Dwems. They only read Dwems, but they read the Dwems rebelliously, which is a problem. And B, you know, so the moral message, so at the end, if, you know, sorry, spoilers, but come on, you haven't seen this movie by now. You know, Keating gets fired over the student suicide because somehow he caused it, or because, you know, he was a free thinker and they thought bad thoughts. And the students actually rat him out. And so as I think you put after you watched the movie, the maybe the hidden message is actually stay in your lane.
Yes. No, it absolutely is. Absolutely is.
You know, one of the kids is dead.
Yeah.
The big professor's fired. Somebody else gets expelled. There's conflict. Stay in your lane, kids.
Yeah, because even the famous scene that everybody knows, you know, even if you haven't seen the movie, everyone's seen the YouTube clip of the boys getting up on their desk and saying, "Captain, my captain." And that's when John Keating, which also, like, if you were fired, they're not going to let you go back in the middle of class to get your stuff out of the closet. Like, let's just say that. Like, if they fired you for being inappropriate around students, they're not going to stop class and be like, yeah, sure, it's okay if you go in the back room and grab some stuff. But anyway, he in middle of class, stops by to pick up the last few things. As he's leaving, a group of the boys stand up on their desk in a moment of rebellion and say, "Oh, Captain, my Captain." But nobody stops him from getting fired. So it's like this supposedly big rebellious moment. But really, they're just like, "Yeah, sorry, dude, you got fired. No big deal."
My colleague, who is the 19th century American lit American poetry specialist, is like, that is the worst Walt Whitman poem ever. That is like the worst one
to choose. Well, you know, so kind of going back to the staying in your lane, so we have these boys who are at this wealthy private school, and, you know, of course their parents have certain expectations for them. And then each of them, because of supposedly being under the influence of John Keating, start doing these things. So one boy goes girl crazy, which, shocker, like, you know, high school boys being girl crazy, isn't that just high school boys?
You don't
boys?
Need a green light for that.
Yeah, you don't need a green light for that. So one of the boys becomes girl crazy. One of the boys starts coming out of his shell a bit. One of the boys who is supposed to go on to medical school, though you know already know that he writes for the paper and things like that, decides he wants to try acting. You know, another boy starts being like a little bit more saucy, I guess you could say, a little bit more saucy. And again, high school boys being saucy, not a shocker. And so literally what ends up happening is they all kind of get punished in their own way for stepping out of their lane. Right. So like the boy who goes girl crazy, he falls for a girl who's dating his dad's best friend's son, and he gets beat up, and that all kind of ends up badly for him. The one who's come, Ethan Hawke, who plays the one who comes out of his shell, who's like finally makes a connection with the teacher, actually betrays his teacher. The one who gets a little saucy ends up being expelled. And then you have, of course, the one who, instead of wanting to be a doctor, wants to become an actor. He's the one who kills himself. And then you have John Keating losing his job. And so at the end of the day, if they all had just stayed in their lane, there would not have been any issues. And so with that, like, it feels like this film that's supposed to be known for, like, rebellion and this passion for teaching, really, that's the message. Like, if no one, if everyone just did what was expected of them, things would have been fine. So what's, you know, for me, like, really, what's the point of this movie?
Yeah, and I think it also, like, there's this weird short circuit because his passion and charisma, and we got to teach these kids to think for themselves through poetry, which, great.
Yeah.
But it also is, like, and it's transformative, and it'll make you a better person or whatever. And maybe it does that, but it also doesn't change institutions and power structures.
No.
And so it's rebellion, but it's also...
Well, you know, so I was, you know, I'm actually, disclosure, I'm a principal. And so, you know, like watching the John Keating character. So like the one thing he really does that you would say is rebellious is he rips out the first chapter of their textbook. Because the way they're being asked to analyze poetry is more in like a mathematical way. And he's like, that's not how we engage with poetry. He tells them to rip out that introduction. You know, curriculum costs a ton of money. So that part of it, I was like, oh, man, you just ripped destroyed a book. But though he does that, he still follows the curriculum. Like, he still literally follows the curriculum. He just picks and chooses the poetry he wants to use in that book. So he doesn't even ditch the book that is, like, dead, stuffy, wealthy old white man. He keeps that book. He keeps teaching it. But instead of in the order prescribed, he just, like, jumps around to the ones that he likes the best. And then is really kind of focusing on engaging them in discussion. And he also is their soccer coach. And so he's building relationships. But there's nothing radical in his pedagogy. Like, there's a couple moments where you actually don't really see him teach at all. You just have these, like, little brief vignettes of him, like, let's rip out this chapter. Or he's talking about something and does a John Wayne voice, which
is his stand-up. Which, to me, as an educator, I think it also speaks to this thing, and I've seen it happen on campuses where I was a student. I've seen it happen on campuses, honestly, where I was an instructor. The male charisma can carry a person sometimes a lot farther than competence. And being liked and being personable and just being charismatic and putting on a show every day.
Yeah.
Whether, you know, students learn anything or whether there's any purpose to what they're doing. Yeah. But being charismatic can go, being the cool professor wearing a beret or something can do a lot for people or do a lot to people in ways that skilled instructors, you know, do a lot better.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. And then, like, in terms of, you know, why he got fired, he then is the student who, kills himself because of the pressure from his father to become a doctor. And so at the beginning of the film, his dad tells him he can't write for the paper anymore because he needs to focus on his studies to prepare to go on to college and medical school. And so he's really disappointed that his dad did that, and he doesn't really stand up to his dad, and his friends are like, why didn't you stand up to your dad with it? And then he meets, you know, of course, John Keating, and he's like, I love literature, I love art. And so he tries out for a play, doesn't tell his dad he tries out for the play. And John Keating, when he meets with him, actually does say, did you tell your father? Like, does your father know? So he actually does the right thing. He says, did you tell your parents? And the student lies to him and says, no, I says, I did tell my dad. And so what ends up happening is his dad finds out, gets really upset, pulls him from school, and they have like a, you know, a fight about it. And that night, he decides to kill himself because his father controls his life and all this other stuff. And so John Keating is then blamed for putting thoughts in his head, which caused him to, you know, join the play and to ultimately kill himself. And so, you know, the other thing about it, though, is, like, you keep remembering it as this person of rebellion, but he still does the right things. Like, you would say, like, if a student came to you with, like, hey, my father wouldn't approve of this, you would say to him, like, well, you should probably talk to your father. So he kind of actually does all the right things. So he's not really this, like, memory of a, like, I don't think he's the kind of, like, outlaw that we actually think he is.
Yeah.
In terms of the film.
Yeah, he's just charismatic and competent. Yeah. Teaches like a stand-up comedian. Which, I think for me, again, as a literature professor, or sometimes literature professor, you know, there's this question about, you know, why read this stuff? Why engage in the canon? You know, and that, the answers to those questions have changed over time.
Yeah.
And so there is a bit of melodramatic nostalgia, I think, for the 1950s in this film.
Yeah.
And also, you know, this notion that, yeah, still the canon would have been this notion of almost sort of a nationalist, like, this is our literature as a people, and this is the best value. I mean, it's the Matthew Arnold thing. Culture is the expression of our best values. Yeah. Which is, again, you know, exclusionary, weird. Today, contemporarily, we sometimes think about writing and literature as a skill set that we build upon.
Well, I think one of the most interesting things for me, though, is, like, so that's set in 1959, which is a pivotal time, right? So you're saying the 60s and kind of the, you know, it's switching decades, and the 60s is more open and more experimentation. And I actually think Roger Ebert makes the point that they should have been talking about the Beats, right? Like, they didn't bring up the Beats, and so he's not really bringing anything into the school that would have been counterculture at that time, or the beginning of counterculture. In the 1959-1960s, that's the really when you think about counterculture happening, and he doesn't really bring in any of that to his classroom.
Yeah.
And also, as he's also, I believe they mentioned that he was teaching at some prestigious school in England, I believe, for a couple of years, for a period of time, before he came back to the school where he graduated from. So it's also not like he was, you know, like in San Francisco teaching at the time, and then came to Vermont and was like, hey, I'm going to break down these walls of stuffiness.
Yeah.
But I think it's interesting. I mean, it was a huge, huge hit. So in terms...
In spite of very lukewarm reviews in its own time.
Yeah.
When it immediately came out, the New York Times kind of slagged on it. Roger Ebert slagged on it. But it did capture something about the popular imagination. And still does.
Yeah.
To this day.
Well, so it cost $16 million to make. And it made almost $235 million.
And it's still quite popular, and still is. I still have students write about Dead Poets Society as the model of what education should be. So I think the thing we should talk about is, yeah, why? what about it, you know, other than just uncritical nostalgia, really appeals to folks in this film?
I think there's a part of one of the things about education, and I think I mentioned it with teachers, is that everyone has gone through formal education. So, like, everyone's gone through K-12 for the most part and has these experiences. So I do think there's that kind of desire for that super teacher who made an impact in your life, and that's what every teacher should be like. And I wonder if it connects on that level. Like, oh, it's the super teacher.
I think, the super teacher, I think charisma, I think that somebody cares that much. I think it's also one of those many education films where I think schooling itself is the enemy.
Yeah.
Right? So that all the other teachers are distant and stuffy, and the curriculum is very dry, very, I would say, you know, to use the Paulo Freire idea, the great Brazilian educator, you know, the teachers teach and the students are taught. It's all lecture. The curriculum is also, I think, somewhat very much removed from their lives and their immediate experiences. I think it also appeals to maybe our culture of, you know, some degree of narcissism. I think because you have not students struggling like most super teacher films. It's students who, like, don't understand basic stuff, and then the teacher comes and they all get it. These boys just need to find themselves.
Yeah.
And so I think that's part of the appeal of the movie, because wouldn't it be nice to just find yourself, or that just, you know, textual pleasure is the thing that'll save us, you know, whether or not, anyway.
Well, I think that's, you know, that's such a good point. And I do feel like one of the reasons why I initially did not connect with this movie is because it's about one percenters.
Yeah.
It is about really wealthy, elite white boys going through this experience. And the one student who does commit suicide, he keeps mentioning that his father isn't as wealthy as some of the other fathers. But then you see their house and you're like, really? Like, your father isn't as wealthy as some of the other fathers? So there's also, like, that it was always weird to me that it's these people that would never be a part of the average person's life. And why did we so connect it? And I think that's what it is. I think when we see a film like Dangerous Minds, that I'm not a fan of that one either, but is it easier to connect with these, like, kind of white proper boys versus inner city youth? And maybe that's a part of it, is that we want to see ourselves as those intellectual, wealthy, above it all kind of people.
Yeah.
Maybe that is a part of it that has to be considered of why people love this film. Also, Robin Williams, I think there is a certain appeal to Robin Williams.
And, I mean, you can't speak ill of the dead, but you can. The Mad Magazine critique of Robin Williams, I think, that stuck with me from the late 90s till now, is that the magic of Robin Williams as an actor, I would say with the exception of One Hour Photo and maybe one or two other films, is that every character he played was Robin Williams.
Yeah, I mean,
and Robin Williams' stand-up. And in fact, even in his teaching, the John Wayne impersonation, I was out of Niagara, I'll say before, right? Is Robin Williams' stand-up. It's in, he does that same voice in the Night at the Met cassette that I dubbed from a friend in.
I mean, I will say it is subdued, Robin Williams.
Yeah, it's subdued, but
to some of his
it's
other
his
films.
Character. It's, yeah. It's his acting persona. And now that he's no longer with us, I think there's even another layer of fuzzy nostalgia for him.
Yeah.
And his memory.
Yes. And I do think, you know, people love and adore Robin Williams.
Yeah.
And I think you're right, like, in terms of One Hour Photo, and even Good Will Hunting, like, he really doesn't do the shtick, but he's the shtick still comes up in this movie. Though it is a subdued Robin Williams.
Yeah.
So I think that does connect to that appeal. But, you know, we mentioned at the beginning, this is harmful, though. The super teacher model is harmful. And, you know, because not everyone is going to be a super teacher, and should you have to be a super teacher? And I just think, and so many people watching this then assume that you have to be a super teacher, and you have to...
And that all education is stuffy, stodgy, irrelevant, repressive.
Yeah.
And, you know, as a good friend of ours who is also a teacher said, you know, yeah, I was a super teacher for a year. It doesn't last.
No, you burn yourself out.
You burn yourself out.
You shine so bright, you fade away, right?
Yes.
Yeah, no, I think it is the sense, you know, we actually do not have it on VHS. Because I think it would be too new. But, you know, we just watched Freedom Riders. And in this, the character is working three jobs, teaching plus two other jobs to buy books. Her marriage falls apart. She's working 7 days a week, you know, these long days. She's doing all this raising money for her students. And she, in her real life, only does it for 4 years because she probably completely burned herself out doing that.
Yeah.
And you know, we always call it the super teacher, but actually what you end up becoming is the lone wolf, right? So you don't build connections with your other teachers, which is actually really super, super important, of having kind of that deep connection and relationship with your coworkers so that you can kind of support each other and help transform as a collective. But for me, like, the other issue with the super teacher is that we don't want to talk about systemic issues. We don't want to talk about funding. We don't want to talk about allocation of resources. We don't want to talk about classroom size. We don't want to talk about quality of curriculum. We don't want to talk about school boards. Like, we don't actually want to talk about the systemic problems. Instead, we want to really hold on to the belief that one amazing super teacher can come in and change everything. And that's just not the case at all.
Yeah. So on that happy note, I guess it's time for... We're going to call this now the Big Four. We're going to kind of shuffle. It was five questions, but they kind of overlapped weird. Let's go to four questions to end the show from now on. This is revolutionary. We're in a car, four questions. This is all new to everybody.
Yes.
But question one's still the same. So, is it camp, retro, a classic, or just an old movie?
For me, it's just an old movie.
Same.
Yeah,
Same. For most people, it's a classic.
Yeah.
You gotta get over that stuff, people.
And it also won all those Oscars, but
it did not win an Oscar.
Oh, it didn't? I thought it did.
No, Roger Ebert called it the worst Oscar Best Picture nomination in recent history. It lost to the even more schlocky Driving Miss Daisy.
Oh, that's right. That's right. That's right. I forgot about that.
Yeah. So, again, to think the travesty.
Yeah.
Do the Right Thing was not nominated for Best Picture.
Which is definitely the better film of both of those films.
But,
yeah.
That's one we should track down on VHS. But, yeah. Dead Poets Society was nominated for Best Picture. Question two. What about the socio-political distance?
I think we had already talked about it a little bit. I mean, especially in now, right? In the 2021, kind of really focusing on these, like, wealthy kids. I don't know. It just kind of feels weird to me. That part feels very weird to me. How about you?
I think there's that. I it is a very white film in a very white world. There's also the weird when the guy, quote unquote, gets the girl, she is passed out drunk at this party. Yeah,
that was
there
so...
is he's, which again was, I guess, acceptable. Okay.
Well, it's scene was so gross. So she passes out on the couch next to him. He kisses her while she's passed out. A friend of her boyfriend sees it, says, "Hey," and, you know, and the boyfriend beats the crap out of him. Rightfully so.
Yes.
But the boyfriend is the bad guy.
Yes, but the palooka boyfriend's the bad guy.
Bad guy. And it's
so,
like,
I think that is also kind of a weird flex.
Yeah.
And I think also the distance, again, they rebel only within the canon. Only read the Dwems.
Yeah, and I mean... and women characters are non-existent. Like, yes. Yeah.
And if the boys rebel about anything, it's they want girls on campus.
Yes.
So that they can make out. That's, yeah. You know, civil rights movement was also happening at the time. Anyway.
And the female character exists just to be an object of obsession. And that's literally it.
Question three, I guess, is then, what about the technical distance, or maybe we can call this one also the room test. Is there anything about how the film is made that becomes an obstacle to its enjoyment, or that you have to put quotes around it because, oh, this is a film of that era?
I think because it was set in 1959, you're not expecting to see stuff, right? So, like,
yeah.
When you see a film that has, like, computers and cell phones, and it was set in the 90s, you immediately are like, oh. This is super dated. And it doesn't really have special effects.
Yeah.
That feel dated.
They get the costuming and the cars right.
They do. The one thing I will say is because the director, Peter Weir, he is Australian. And he did a film called Panic at Picnic Rock. And that film is really about, like, visual. Like, it's not necessarily... I mean, there's definitely a story to it. But he's very much about a... visual aesthetic, not necessarily storytelling, which I think is a part of, like, some 70s and 80s.
And Panic at Picnic Rock, the visuals are incredible.
They're amazing.
Yes.
So there was also, like, I think thinking about him as a director, he's not necessarily a director who's interested in, like, a through line. He's interested in making it visually interesting. But I think when you want to have a story that has a through line, having a visually interesting director.
You need a script.
Yeah.
You need a better script.
You need a better script. Absolutely.
You need a script with a plot.
So if there's anything that feels kind of like that to me, is that
part. That does kind of make it a bit, yeah, a period piece. So question four, the old question five, is it a keeper?
well, we end up keeping everything. But I think...
We do end up keeping everything, but...
Is it a film that I want to revisit now? Probably 20 years from now, we'll be teaching a class, and we're like, oh yeah, maybe I should do this one again, and we'll pull it out and watch it one more time.
Yeah.
But I do think it's actually, you know, for the class you're teaching right now about film, I do think it's a good film
teaching
to
talk, in film.
I think it's a good film...
representation of teaching and education in film.
...to reference around teaching in film. And to critically dissect it, especially if you want to become a future educator. I do think there's that importance for it because it's so bad and because the character is so bad, but there is such this vast interest in this film. I do think it's really important for future educators to think about it and critically analyze this particular film. That's the only reason why I would say keep it around.
Yeah, I guess for me, keep it around because, yeah, I got this class and I might teach it again someday. It might not be 20 years. It might be actually 2 years might be the cycle for the class. So I'll probably keep it on the syllabus.
But, yeah, Peter Weir, the better thing to see is Panic at Picnic Rock or The Truman Show by him. So those, I think, are much, much better films that he's done than this particular movie.
And on that note, we're almost at Sheets as we're driving. And our dog Libby has decided to now start working on the busy bone that we gave her 50 miles back. So that's the crunching sound you hear. And I think that's a good place to end.
Thank you, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.